Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to meet Trevor Scholes, the author of a new book called Uber Worked and Underpaid, How Workers Are Disrupting the Digital Economy. And we'll talk about Uber and more. Uber's been in the news this week after a round of sexual harassment claims and a damage control effort that's underway, led by Arianna Huffington. And also, just today, Friday, the 24th of February, Uber has been sued by Google's division called Waymo, accusing Uber of stealing intellectual property. It's a fascinating discussion about the new disruption and extraction economy, and I think you'll find it pretty interesting. I want to thank the people who subscribe to my podcast and support my work, people like Faith Peoples, Cheryl Fleming, Dick Attlee, and Mark Brodsky. They're all subscribers to the podcast, and I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. No matter what device you're using, you click on Menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. You'll see the options there and bonus books available for new annual subscribers with a mailing address in the continental U.S. Thanks for listening to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast, we take another look at Uber. Baby, would you drive my car? Would you drive your car and let me exploit you? In Hollywood, people who want to break into the movies are writing a screenplay, working as a barista, and here in the Bay Area, where the so-called ride-sharing app, I call it an ersatz taxi company, Uber got its start, we have many people, friends of mine, who spend their extra hours driving for Uber and generating a little extra cash. And today we're going to talk about some of the recent news developments about Uber and about the big picture of what is called the gig economy, which is highly exploitive of the labor force. And to discuss this with me, I've invited Trevor Scholes. He's Associate Professor of Culture and Media at Eugene Lang College at the New School for Liberal Arts, where he also chairs the conference series, The Politics of Digital Culture at the New School. And his latest book, he's quite prolific, is Uber Worked and Underpaid, How Workers Are Disrupting the Digital Economy. Trevor, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks for having me.
And if people are trying to figure out your first name, it's Robert spelled backwards.
That would also be true, yes.
I used to work with a talk show host here in San Francisco who used the nom de guerre Bob Trevor. And Robert was his given first name, but he, I think, had a long ethnic last name. And so for many years, he was gracing the airwaves here. And Trevor, you've also written, as I mentioned, quite actively. In 2009, you published The Internet as Playground and Factory. In 2014, yeah. Digital Labor, Sweatshops, Picket Lines, Barricades. And in 2015, Platform Cooperativism, The Internet Ownership Democracy. And I'm going to draw on some of the themes a little bit later. But first, I wanted to get your take on some of the breaking news this week about Uber. And it started over last weekend during the president's holiday break when I read a lengthy post online penned by Susan Fowler Rigetti. And she was recruited to Uber to the engineering department as part of their effort to diversify their workforce. And Uber's not alone. Silicon Valley companies are largely male, and they're largely white or Asian. And so there is a drive for diversity, and Uber went on a hiring spree of women. And Susan Fowler published a piece describing sexual harassment that she experienced and sharing stories of other women at Uber who had the same type of experience. And now we've got a damage control operation underway. Travis Kalanick, the CEO, is saying that he's shocked and he's going to try to fix this. He's assigned Arianna Huffington, who is an opportunist and a sellout of major proportions, to try to paper this over for Uber. And he's also hired Eric Holder, the most recent attorney general. Actually, he wasn't the most recent, but he served for 7 years in the Obama administration to run interference on the legal front. So that's a long-winded summary of what's been going on. What's your take on this, Trevor?
Well, I mean, apart from what happened in this particular case, and I think it's interesting to look at the general atmosphere or conditions for white-collar workers in Silicon Valley. So, you know, this is not so often talked about, right? So what you hear frequently is the situation of the Uber drivers or the people who work on Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is a crowdsourcing platform for Amazon.com. So you hear about those working conditions, but rarely do people focus on those. So, I mean, you know, I mean, there's a long track record of Travis Kalanick making, you know, derisive comments about women. And so I think this played out now also all across the company. But it's really, I think it's important to not see this as an isolated incident, but also you can draw many parallels to Amazon, which last summer the New York Times revealed the in-depth report on the situation of white-collar workers in Seattle at Amazon. So the managers, you know, the bookkeepers, even the engineers, you know, and this one quote stuck with me. I still remember where this one manager said that there wasn't a single person at Amazon whom he hadn't seen crying at one particular point at their desk. So this sort of stuck with me. You can look at the warehouses of Amazon where people get reprimanded for taking breaks that are not scheduled, as short as 2 minutes talking to a coworker between shelves in the warehouses of Amazon. If they get two such reports, they get fired. So it's somehow taking, I think, with Amazon at least, this idea of the efficiency that is so pervasive throughout the business thinking in that sector, then also to these work conditions, right? I mean, to not have a worker be able to talk to their colleague for 2 minutes between shelves, it's just, you know, not helping any business. I mean, that's not even, you know, business in a good business sense. It just doesn't make any sense.
And so, Trevor,
kind of condition you'd see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recall that New York Times story too. It was graphic and shocking to learn that the meat grinder conditions that people work under at Amazon,
right,
and they're afraid to submit their expense reports, and they often end up subsidizing the company. And what you described about the warehouse operations, we have many workers in this country today who carry a computer device, a smartphone, and if you're a FedEx driver or you're a UPS driver, they know exactly how long you are out of the truck. And at the end of the day, a supervisor can, you know, take a scan of your activities and say, hey, what did you do here? Who are you talking to? Is there a hot secretary in there? You also cover in your book about the way that there are now workers whose computer cameras are turned on at all times, and there are remote minders who are watching them to make sure that they're actually, looking at the screen and working instead of smoking a cigarette and talking to their cellmate in the cube.
That's right, yeah. I mean, you know, so this worker surveillance, you have also going throughout this whole sector, where basically every move is surveyed, which is now possible because of the sort of algorithmic control that's happening, right? This is also what you see with Uber, right, where this is this soft control, right, this algorithmic control that's happening with drivers there. So it's, I think there are lots of parallels.
And with the situation at Uber this week, you know, I mentioned the damage control moves, and we have Travis saying that he is shocked that this has been going on. But this is a high testosterone environment. They're sitting on billions of dollars in capital. They're running huge losses, and they keep pivoting. And now, of course, it's the driverless car that they see as the business plan that will actually make Uber profitable. But, you know, these moves don't really, you know, have much sincerity, in my view. This is just PR.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that these, I think today Uber was evaluated at $70 billion, right? And so what all this money is really buying them is really regulation, right? Or deregulation, to be precise. So basically to sway, you know, local regulators to rule in their favor and to change laws or regulations in cities so that they can operate better. So we saw this here in New York City, where it became quite scary for Mayor de Blasio, who tried to simply just see if the congestion in Manhattan that is increasing has actually something to do with Uber. And they so drastically shot back at that that it was quite threatening to hit his administration. So if you have so much money, right, you can, if you have so many resources, you can really derail even a mayor of New York City, if you like. And what's very interesting about that is that they tried to mobilize their consumers, right, so the people, the passengers of, and the people that use Uber, as a grassroots activist movement pushing against the mayor. Right? No, not ever in history has a company been able to reach all their customers in this way and wrap them essentially into this campaign, right? So they added a feature to the app here in New York City where people could directly complain to the mayor. And so that, you know, is a completely new kind of dimension that this company is sort of mobilizing. And so does Airbnb, by the way. Airbnb does the same thing. They're also using their platform to mobilize hosts against particular, you know, city governments in Barcelona and other cities.
Indeed. And here in San Francisco, where both of those companies were founded, we have a mayor of he's been in office for about 4 years now, and he's captive to a tech investor who's made millions off Facebook and Twitter and other early investments. His name is Ron Conway, and basically he is the conduit to City Hall for Uber and Airbnb. And Airbnb, for example, refuses to disclose exactly how many hosts it has. We have a city ordinance that requires them to file and register and to pay a hotel tax. It's believed that only about a third at most are complying. And there's really just a standoff. And Uber flexes its muscle, Airbnb flexes their muscle, and many governments will stand down. They've spread a lot of campaign cash around. They've hired very muscular PR people with political experience, and they really are operating in a very aggressive and almost militaristic mode.
Yeah, they come into cities and you know, companies like Uber, but also TaskRabbit, you know, you name it, Handy, and often break a lot of laws. I mean, so there's this sort of nullification of federal law and local regulations, and basically operating as if they are in a legal void, and then basically creating a consumer base, and then basically holding that consumer base up and say, well, look here, these are all these happy customers, so maybe your laws are all antiquated, you know, you are dinosaurs, you should really, you know, change these laws so that they fit their extractive business model. And you know what? I think what's really most important about this is I think these shortcomings, we see them so clearly. Right? So now we learn about the working conditions in those offices for the engineers, for the management. And we know these stories since 2014, at least, about the drivers, right? How many of them are really close to minimum wage, some even below minimum wage, despite the fact that in Uber in New York was spreading the news that drivers are making $100,000 a year, which, you know, all these investigative journalists coming out and trying to find this driver who makes $100,000 a year, of course, not finding anyone even close. And but I think much more important is, like, what can you actually do about it, right? So what can you, how can you intervene in this situation? And this is also what I'm trying to do in the book, right? How can you actually intervene in this situation and bring about some positive change? And not in a way that is, let's say, overly academic and, you know, utopian, so far away and out of reach, but in a way that when you leave your office today, when you leave your flat today, there is something you can start working on, contributing to a near-term solution, right? Something that, you know, we can start working on right now and that is very feasible and concrete. And this is how in 2014 I basically proposed to what I called platform cooperativism, by which I simply mean, you know, to ask this question, what would it be like if there would be a platform just like Uber, but owned by the drivers? Mm-hmm. Right? What would it be like if you have a stock photography site that is owned by the photographers that sell their images through that platform? And, I mean, because just if you imagine, like, this morning when you got up and you, you know, brew your coffee and you have your cup of coffee and you sit down and you, whatever, pull your mobile phone out, and, you know, all of us doing that are, you know, ending up on 5 or 6 websites that are owned by a number of people that is so small that you could fit them into a Google bus, right? and so this basically the claim and the demand is that, you know, we should own or co-own the sites, the platforms that we depend on most. So basically all this rhetoric, this myth of democracy that is, you know, so much coming out of this blur between counterculture and cyberculture in the 70s, and is still so much prevalent today with this sort of obfuscation, right, that these companies, these sharing economy companies are using, where they almost make you feel like this is about a counter-revolution, you know, this is a disruption, and it's about love, and it's about sharing, and almost intimacy, right? They almost sound like they are your lover or something. And this is, you know, an obfuscation, which is really about selling you their service. And so I think in 2014, when I made that proposal, I suddenly realized, like, wow, there are actually, you know, dozens and by now, you know, several hundred companies that do exactly that, that basically offer platforms that bring the cooperative working model, so the model of the cooperative, to the digital economy, that make it possible for workers to co-own these platforms.
I think that's a fascinating vision, Trevor. And I think that we're seeing pressure build. Uber, you know, part of the disruption that is unaddressed is that they have filled the already crowded streets of major cities with more damn cars. And Airbnb is sucking up the inventory of rental housing, and it's driving up the cost in San Francisco. It's gotten really critical where, you know, essential elements of the workforce can no longer afford to live here. And so that disruption, I think, will fuel people evaluating alternative models. And in New York, you have a service called Juno that's in a beta test right now, and they at least share some of the ownership with their drivers, according to what I've read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There are examples like Better Rides and many others. Maybe more, you know, also interesting service called Up and Go, that comes out of Queens here and basically offers a platform where you can get your home cleaning, your house cleaning, eventually also your pet care and your child care. And all of these services are provided by cooperatives. In the case of child care, in fact, provided by immigrant women. And so it addresses many of these issues and the shortcomings of the sharing economy in one go, and turns what is so extractive and worthy of our critique into something that's actually quite genuinely about the sharing economy, and that is really, creating, I use this term, a sanctuary platform. Right? We talk about sanctuary cities, but in a way it's a sanctuary platform where people can work shielded from these economic and political pressures that are mounting since last November.
We're talking with Trevor Scholes. His new book is Uberworked and Underpaid. It's out in softcover now, and it's a fascinating look, not just at Uber, but at many of these companies. And you get the impression that Trevor never sleeps. He's always got at least three screens going because he knows about so many of these startups and other operations that use some of these similar models. And Trevor, just today, we learned that Waymo, which is the self-driving car division of Google, has sued Uber, claiming that when they hired a top engineer, a guy named Lewandowski, that he grabbed a lot of the critical files about LiDAR. LiDAR is the system that allows a car to navigate itself. And this looks pretty ugly, where the two Silicon Valley giants are now pissing on each other. And, Google has deeper pockets even than Uber does. So what do you make of this conflict, and where do you think it might go?
Well, I mean, these are the turf wars that we saw with, if you remember sort of in the history of the Internet, right? I mean, the same happened with browsers. If you think about the introduction of Internet Explorer, right, which basically pushed out Netscape, which was dominating the market until then. This has sort of in the history of technology always been the case, these kind of turf wars. But, automation is a very interesting question, right? And to what extent, what kind of solution is, can you, or what kind of alternative is there to this automation, or what will this automation actually bring about? What kind of reality will that bring about? So, there's this famous and often quoted Oxford University study, which, claims that there will be 47% of all workers will be affected by automation in some way by 2030. And I think there will be some sectors that will be heavily affected. I think there is also, I think the study is somewhat exaggerated, though. I think it will be more an augmentation, right? So maybe now the nurse of the dermatologist can check moles with a, enhanced iPhone and cross-check a database of melanomas, right? So these kind of things we will see happening, and they're happening for a long time, right? If you just look at what happens with pilots, their work is automated. I think it started in the 80s. It's already very pervasive. And I think answers to this is, what we need to ask is essentially the same question. What can, cooperative ownership, what can democratic ownership contribute to artificial intelligence, to this discussion? I think it's an urgent question. I don't have an answer to that question, but I think this is something we need to ask. And then, of course, also it invigorates the discussion about universal basic income, which is, an old idea, which was in different versions supported by Democrats and Republicans. Nixon was a big supporter of universal basic income, which basically means, in a nutshell, that, every person, every citizen gets a check in the mail without really working for it, but then at the same time, all social support being cut, right? So Social Security would be closed down, unemployment closed down, all of that gone, but you would automatically get a check in the mail. So, I mean, I say there are certainly rigorous discussions about this in Europe because, you know, no matter what your qualifications will be in a world that's dominated by automation, there may just simply not be enough jobs even for people that are qualified. Right? And then add to that the sort of sharpening inequality that we've seen since 1978, where, you know, obviously the wages of American workers stagnate while their productivity has gone up. And so put this all together, and you're really in a sort of interesting situation that calls for, you know, some solution, some resolve that, you know, is also heightened by the, you know, recent wave of nationalism and all these cultural schisms that are sort of playing out now, right?
And Trevor, as you correctly point out in the book, this disruption is really much more of an extraction model, where instead of allowing, you know, somebody who needs to get somewhere to coordinate for free using an app, and anybody can create an app these days, you know, we have a for-profit company, an intermediary inserted there, which kind of like the health insurance companies, you know, extracts profit before, you know, any services have actually been provided. And, you know, this model, you know, I certainly, you know, see the appeal of your co-op model. The hard part is that we're in this capitalist economy where the pro-capitalist mentality is, you know, being, you know, activated and enhanced even more by the Trump problem.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, what you've seen is, I mean, I don't know what you where you're going with this sort of, you know, suggestion that we're living in a capitalist context. Of course, it's a capitalist context. But, you know, like the history of cooperatives over the last 200 years has shown clearly that, you know, cooperatives are not destroyed by corporate competitors, and vice versa, that cooperatives haven't really destroyed corporations either. Right? So it's a coexistence. The question is that they haven't really taken over. That's, of course, another thing. So I think what I would claim is that there can be a slice of this economy that can be cut out and be turned into a more fair and dignified economy if you follow this model. And many examples that I mentioned in the book exactly do that, right? So they show that it is possible. Stocksy, this stock photography site that is cooperatively owned, had a $7 million in revenue last year. You know, there's a eBay, Amazon that is cooperatively run in Germany, Fairmondo that is now also starting in the UK and also looking at starting in San Francisco. But I think one thing that's important to point out, you know, I think it's not that the people in Silicon Valley, you know, that there is something sort of deeply ethically wrong with everybody starting a company in Silicon Valley, but it is more just a logic of this investor model, right? The venture capitalist model, because if somebody gives you, you know, $500,000, $1 million, $5 million, and then says, okay, 18 to 24 months to become profitable, right, which is often the imperative, then you have to be in this extraction mode. I mean, there is no other way than turning into a vacuum cleaner, right, and basically thinking about the market in no other way but sucking up value, and which is a very different approach than thinking about it in terms of, you know, social value, creating community value, creating actually lasting value for a given community, right? So this is there are big differences.
Trevor, in the book you write, the internet has become a highly efficient enabler of unethical work arrangements. Technologies in a genuine sharing economy, platform cooperatives, and public interest startups can be operated with embedded values that support the commonwealth. Beyond technology, mm-hmm. other factors that impact the role of the labor platforms discussed include a lack of regulation, the decline of labor unions, mm-hmm. the society-wide reorganization of work, and publicly traded stockholder companies, which are driven by growth imperatives. And I would add mm-hmm. what amounts to confiscation of the money that an average taxi driver has paid to get a license or a medallion. In San Francisco, mm-hmm. it costs, I believe, $160,000 to get the right mm-hmm. to drive a yellow cab. And mm-hmm. anybody with a car that meets the minimum requirements of Uber or Lyft and who has a decent driving record can get on the road and go to work in that trade. And it undermines mm-hmm. the professionals who've been doing it for years. Now, I don't think they did it perfectly, and I am, you know, open to improvements in the licensed taxi cab model. But, you know, Uber has made no attempt to address the disadvantage that they are dealing to the establishment transportation modes.
Well, you should call it out as what it is. It's illegal. this kind of unfair competition that they are mounting, they can only do that because they basically are not restrained, or they think they are not restrained, or they operate as if they are not restrained by these laws, right? I mean, they are clear laws, and they violate them. And basically, in every city, you know, all over the planet, from, you know, France to Berlin to New York, everywhere, it's the same way. So they basically come in, operate illegally, establish a consumer base that is smitten by their consumer convenience that's undoubtedly there, and also by their innovation. I mean, this has to be mentioned, right? I mean, I really do prefer calling it cabs through an app than being on the phone with somebody where I can't actually ever be sure that the taxi will come, right? Because mm-hmm. they didn't understand me, or the shit just doesn't show up or whatever. So, I mean, there is innovation, genuine innovation there. But the question is really, like, who benefits from that innovation, right? So it's like, where is the financial benefit going, right? So, like, is this actually benefiting the community, or is this a short-term convenience that over the long run, you know, and this is something that is often completely ignored. There's always this short-termism in how we think about Silicon Valley. It's always about the immediate effect, right? So, like, how does this benefit the consumer right now? Not really looking at the larger sort of, you know, society-wide reorganization of labor markets that is taking place through companies like Uber and many, many others, which basically shift people away from direct employment. Not that I have a romantic relationship to employment, but it did have legal protections, right? It had, you know, the 8-hour workday. It had the weekend, health insurance, workplace worker protections and harassment and all of these kind of protections that are suddenly gone, right? Also, it creates a workforce that is so distributed that it is almost impossible to organize them as a bargaining unit, which puts unions completely out of the picture. So, and this is interesting if you think about examples like Green Taxi in Denver, which really shows that you can operate this differently. So Green Taxi is a taxi company that, turned into a cooperative. It is made up of immigrants from 78 nations, and it has collaborated, worked with the communications union, which has helped it to sway local regulation. And this speaks to the quote that you read from the book, because regulation is often not in favor of, you know, cooperatives and other alternatives. It's really in support of monopolies. And so you need to sway local, you know, legislators, just like those Ubers and TaskRabbit have to do it. Also, cooperatives have to do that as well, like to basically sway them to rule in their favor. And this is where unions come in and can find a new role in basically working with and supporting these cooperatives. So this is what we've seen in Denver, which has now Green Taxi, and Denver has now 37% of market share and growing. So it's very successful.
Seattle, the city council passed a resolution unanimously yeah. permitting Uber drivers to organize under yeah. a labor union, and I see progress mm-hmm. there. Trevor, I also want to give credit. There is a blog and podcast called The Rideshare Guy. He's based in Southern California, and mm-hmm. they put out some pretty interesting information for the drivers, the workforce. And for example, the company lost more than $2.2 billion in the first nine mm-hmm. months of last year, more than $800 million in the third quarter alone. And Uber is heavily subsidizing each ride with its venture capital money. They're paying mm-hmm. only about 41 passengers are paying only about 41% of the actual cost of their trips. So mm-hmm. that is a stunning revelation to me about mm-hmm. how unsustainable this model is. And mm-hmm. it's very clear that Uber is just using the drivers and their cars as a transition to the autonomous vehicles, where humans will no longer be needed. And so that's apparent to most people. I'm wondering if all of the Uber drivers know the extent to which they're being exploited and that they will be declared unnecessary in the near future.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And there are many... There are many blogs and podcasts run by very experienced Uber drivers who basically explain also the Uber algorithm to the drivers, which is kind of very deceptive. So in many ways, the information that you see, such as how much money you made, etc., is not always accurate. And drivers often can't pick up the car that is closest to them. And there are all kinds of things that are quite opaque in the algorithm. And so there are now these many of these drivers step up and, help their colleagues.
And Trevor, as we wrap up here, I just want to cite there's a great deal in the book, and I recommend it to people who'd like to get your vision for a very different model of these new technologies and the way that they're applied and implemented. But I mentioned earlier that Arianna Huffington is on the board of Uber, and as a woman, she was tasked with papering over the sexual harassment charges that surfaced over the past week or so. And in your book, mm-hmm. Uber Worked and Underpaid, you recount the episode where she sold the Huffington Post to AOL for $315 million. And many of the yeah. people who had been writing and writing great stuff for the Huffington Post for zero pay said, hey, okay, you got $315 million. Are you going to start to pay us? And she, in a Marie Antoinette moment, instead of let them eat cake, she said, well, go ahead, go on strike. You quote her here.
Right.
And I just wanted to get your thoughts because she's, an interesting woman. I've known her since she was married to Michael Huffington, and he ran for the United States Senate here in California, tried to buy that seat with $35 million of his fortune back in 1992. And she was promoting a guy who was a real fraud, and that's when she was a Republican. Right. She has pivoted, redefined herself, and has a fairly positive public persona, at least is my perception. But there's a lot of dirty laundry in her closet.
Yeah, yeah. No, I met her, a few years ago, and, it's a quite charismatic person, and I think a lot of people felt quite positively about her. She had, like you said, she was a Republican turned Democrat, and she had a lot of sympathies on her side. So people felt like, I write for Arianna for free, and but then when she turned around and sold the whole thing to AOL, people felt really betrayed. And this is nothing unusual in sort of history of the internet. There are many other examples. You can go back to the AOL chat room moderators in the 90s it's a different situation, but it's not that different, where people were kind of lured into volunteer work by, you know, implicit suggestion that they might gain AOL employment, and then they sued for back wages because, you know, they had volunteered and so on. So, like, there's all these, you know, this is all not so new, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it was entirely legal, right? Arianna Huffington never promised anyone that they would be paid by posting on the, you know, or being aggregated into the Huffington Post. But people still felt that it was very, you know, morally dubious, to say the least, that she then took their labor and, you know, sold this platform with all their work.
Well, I would also note that during the Bush administration, the Huffington Post was a reliable critic of the Republican government. And after Obama got elected, the politics at Huffington Post was buried under an avalanche of cheesy tabloid celebrity, just clickbait bullshit. And there's still underneath that, you can find some decent writing that people still contribute to the Huffington Post, but it is a very different publication than it was 10 years ago.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, you know, in a way you could say the model is similar. Also, if you look at BuzzFeed, right?
Sure.
So they have a large number of not very qualified journalists, but among them, they do have... you know, I think 5 or 6 Pulitzer Prize winning journalists, right? So, and is to basically, you know, I guess brand the company as a whole through these few absolutely, you know, excelling, prolific writers and thereby selling the rest of the platform, which is really more focused on advertisement than on journalism.
Well, you're right. And a colleague of mine, Jason Leopold, just moved from Vice News over to BuzzFeed, and he acknowledges that both of them are largely driven by this eyeball attraction cheesy stuff, but they do some good journalism, and you're correct. It is a much smaller population of real journalists compared to the feature writers, if we can call them that.
Right.
But let me end by quoting this statement from Arianna Huffington related to the sexual harassment cases at Uber. Quote, I just joined Travis and Leanne Hornsey, Uber's recently hired chief human resources officer, for the company's weekly meeting. We spent over an hour discussing women in the workplace and talking about the review that's underway by Eric Holder and Tammy Albaran into diversity and inclusion at Uber. Travis spoke very honestly about the mistakes he's made and about how he wants to take the events of the last 48 hours to build a better Uber. It was great to see employees holding managers accountable. Now, this last line is the one I choke on, because the whole issue that Susan Rigetti raised was that managers repeatedly protected the harassers because they were high performers. And so,
exactly.
I mean, this is an Orwellian kind of statement on her part.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think if you really want to fundamentally change these situations, if you fundamentally want to change the digital economy in one that is more aligned with ideas of social justice and, you know, gender equality, a fairer workplace, and, you know, a fairer future of work, then you really have to change ownership models. I think it will be very hard to do within the existing constraints. And I think especially young programmers, you know, who just joined Microsoft, who just joined Amazon, or who just joined Uber, they should really think about, you know, if they don't want to work for a company that has a much more meaningful outlook, probably make less money, right? But thereby, but still contributing to that's really something that is worthwhile and contributing to a better future by joining a, you know, cooperative platform.
Trevor, I've really enjoyed talking with you today. Thanks for joining me. Trevor Schultz is the author of Uber Worked and Underpaid, How Workers Are Disrupting the Digital Economy, and he's a professor of culture and media at the New School in New York City. Thank you, Trevor.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
There you go with a fascinating look at Uber and the gig economy. Your comments and feedback, welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. happy trails to you.